You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One with me, Nancy Durham. On today's show...
Today I'm announcing a series of measures that will continue to increase the costs on Russia and on those responsible for what is happening in Ukraine.
The U.S. and the EU announce asset freezes and travel bans against Russian officials. Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard will be here to discuss the latest on the Crimean crisis, as well as the other big stories of the day. Plus...
And what's so stinking about it?
It's a stinking world because there's no law and order anymore.
From Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange to Andy Warhol's Chelsea Girls, we'll look back at the time when America broke all cultural taboos with Robert Hoffler, author of the book Sexplosion. Also ahead, we'll discuss the growing influence of digital art, and we'll talk with our correspondent in Montreal. That's Midori House with me, Nancy Durham, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych is among officials who've been given travel bans and had their assets frozen as Western powers hit back over Crimea's referendum. Other figures include Sergei Askyonov, Crimea's acting leader, Dmitry Rogozin, a Russian deputy prime minister, and Valentina Matviyenko, head of the upper house of the Russian parliament. Several of Russian President Putin's advisers are also named on the United States list. Mr. Putin himself was not sanctioned, and President Barack Obama has described the measures as an initial step.
We'll continue to make clear to Russia that further provocations will achieve nothing except to further isolate Russia and diminish its place in the world. The international community will continue to stand together to oppose any violations of Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. And continued Russian military intervention in Ukraine will only deepen Russia's diplomatic isolation and exact a greater toll on the Russian economy.
European Union measures target 21 people, but their names are not being released until later. EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton says Russia can still halt the crisis.
We want to underline very clearly that there is still time to avoid a negative spiral and to reverse current developments. And we call on the Russian leadership not to take steps to annex Crimea and instead to take steps to de-escalate this crisis.
Officials in Malaysia say they believe the co-pilot of missing flight MH370 spoke the last words to ground controllers before it vanished. Initial investigations indicate that co-pilot Farik Abdul Hamid said, "All right, good night," shortly before the plane disappeared. Investigators are looking into the possibility that the Boeing 777's crew were involved in its disappearance. The search for the aircraft has extended into two large air corridors. 26 countries have been asked to help find the jet, which went missing over a week ago, with 239 people on board. Mick Jagger's fashion designer girlfriend, L. Ren Scott, has been found dead in her New York City apartment. A spokesman for Mr. Jagger, who's on tour in Australia, said the singer was completely shocked and devastated. Police say the death is being investigated as a possible suicide. The 49-year-old began dating the 70-year-old Rolling Stones singer in 2001. Ms. Scott cancelled her London Fashion Week show last month, apparently because of production delays. US Navy SEALs have taken control of an oil tanker seized by rebels earlier this month at a Libyan port by three armed men. The seizure embarrassed the Libyan government after the vessel was loaded with oil and managed to escape from the port. The Pentagon says no one was hurt as the military gained control of the ship. The operation was approved by President Barack Obama and requested by the Libyan and Cypriot governments. A strong earthquake has been felt near Los Angeles in the early hours of Monday morning, 9 kilometres from the district of Westwood. The 4.4 magnitude tremor is the strongest earthquake in Los Angeles since the last aftershocks from the 1994 Northridge quake. Officials say nerves were rattled, but there was no major damage or injury. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
So you are listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18:05. That means it's 14:05 in New York. Joining me in the studio now with their take on the news, our regular Monocle contributor, Jeffrey Kaufman. He's a veteran American network television correspondent, and he's a Canadian journalist, fellow Canadian he is. And John Everard, writer and former British ambassador to North Korea and Belarus. Welcome, both of you, to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, let's kick off with Crimea. I guess, obviously, the United States and the European Union have announced they will impose sanctions on Moscow following yesterday's referendum in Crimea, in which officials say 97% of the voters backed an exit from Ukraine. Well, this is what Barack Obama had to say during his press briefing.
First, as authorized by the executive order I signed 2 weeks ago, we are imposing sanctions on specific individuals responsible for undermining the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and government of Ukraine. We're making it clear that there are consequences for their actions. Second, I have signed a new executive order that expands the scope of our sanctions. As an initial step, I'm authorizing sanctions on Russian officials, entities operating in the arms sector in Russia, and individuals who provide material support to senior officials of the Russian government. And if Russia continues to interfere in Ukraine, we stand ready to impose further sanctions.
So that's the American president there sounding very authoritative, or trying to be sounding that way. John Everard?
I reckon that, well, first, it did sound authoritative. It was well delivered, at the very least. This is slap-on-the-wrist type sanctions. This is 21 people, none of them right at the top in Moscow, and with limited asset freezes on those, as one Russian put it, only those who actually have assets abroad. So it's actually not going to affect even some of the people on the list of 21 people. Why? I think that they are holding a lot of sanctions in reserve. They're keen to make clear that they have extra sticks with which they can thwack Russia should Russia continue to misbehave and should Russia escalate. In particular, I think they have kept away at this stage from economic sanctions, which, of course, would hurt Russia much worse than any of these that the sanctions so far announced.
So step by step, Jeffrey, do you think this beginning can do something?
I think it simply illustrates just how powerless the West is in this situation. And of course, as John points out, you know, there's some key names missing from this list. At the top, one might think Vladimir Putin, but of course they wouldn't dare poke him in the eye under such volatile circumstances. And I think they're afraid. They're trying to make a token gesture, and in fact, there was a tweet from one of the I think it's 11. The Americans are sanctioning 11 Russians, and Europe is sanctioning 21, and there's some overlap there. This is just a token gesture. But I think this now feels like a fait accompli. 97% of the people
Those
of Crimea,
voted. Yep.
If we accept that this was a legitimate poll, and I think we have reason to be suspect, but 97%, you know, it does sound like a Soviet-era election, doesn't it?
It does sound like a Soviet-era election, indeed.
But in all likelihood, it's possible, though, if the Russians voted, that's the way they were going to go.
Yeah, if you have everybody who doesn't agree with becoming part of Russia boycott the poll, then 97%?
Right, right. The Tatars did not vote. That's right. They said that they didn't consider it legitimate, and they weren't going to legitimize it by voting. They're a minority, so even had they voted, the numbers would still have been significant. But what happens now? It seems inevitable that this is going to become part of Russia, and there'll be a lot of protests. That said, Vladimir Putin has kind of brazenly forged ahead, and even he can't predict the consequences of his actions.
Let me try and answer that question. What happens now? Firstly, can I pick up an earlier point you made? The sanctions did not include Vladimir Putin himself or anybody close to him. There are good reasons for that. At a first round of sanctions, you do not put people right at the top on your sanctions list. Eventually, you are going to have to negotiate with these people. And you only actually slap sanctions on them as a very last resort. Has Putin miscalculated? He's grossly miscalculated. I'm pretty sure that this Western reaction wasn't anywhere in his playbook. He certainly wasn't expecting sanctions to be imposed on Russia. It's important to remember that, pinprick if you like, but Russia thinks of itself still as a major world power. Sanctions is something you oppose on tinpot African dictatorships, not on Russia. And Russian prestige has been badly hurt. Okay,
hasn't Putin been, hasn't the EU, Europe, and maybe the States too been wrong-footed by Putin? He got in there, did the deed. The Crimea's already setting their clocks back 2 hours or ahead, whichever direction it's going. They've applied for membership in the Federation. Fait accompli, indeed.
Fait accompli up to a point. Putin, I think, was hoping that he could actually start a shooting war. He's been trying to provoke Ukrainian forces for several weeks, and they have heroically refused to rise to the bait. He didn't get that. He's forced to sit in Crimea without the moral high ground that he might have claimed if a fighting had broken out.
And having squandered $50 billion on the Sochi Olympics, which are now ancient history, tried to rebrand the new Russia.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, when you think about it, doesn't that feel like so long ago? And it was only a few
yesterday,
weeks.
Yesterday.
You know, one of the questions, though, that I don't have an answer to this. Ukraine is about 45 million people. Crimea is just 2 million people. So they voted to, if we accept this, that this is a legitimate vote, to join Russia. What does this do for the other 43 million people in Ukraine? And if they were allowed to vote, would they go in the direction that they were going in last November when all of this began to boil over? And would they now, are they now being pushed into the orbit of Europe? Or is Europe going to be reluctant to embrace them?
They are being pushed into the orbit of Europe. Europe is reluctant to embrace a large, struggling, poor country like Ukraine. But the geopolitical imperative is enormous. Sorry.
This is the heart of it, I think. I was at George Soros' talk last week, and he very much said this is Europe's opportunity to get in and embrace these Ukrainians who want to be in the group.
And that's
the time to spend money there.
That is where Putin's giant miscalculation may be written in history. And if that's, and it's, we don't know the answer yet, but it does seem that he is setting up the rest of Ukraine, which is most of Ukraine, to move towards Europe, which it was in the process of doing just last November.
Absolutely. And if this happens, this is a massive Russian loss and a huge Western victory. Fait accompli, you were saying before? Yes, for tomorrow, for next week, for next month, for this year. The point is that although Putin holds all the cards in the short term, he now occupies Crimea, his long-term position is very weak. And the West is playing a long-term game. The Russian economy is floundering. This has been a very expensive gambit, quite apart from the $50 billion, which, as you rightly say, he's now squandered. Keeping Crimea going is not going to be cheap, and Crimea can be squeezed any time that the West wants to put pressure on Russia, like Kaliningrad. He's now got sort of sore fingers stuck out in various awkward places. And eventually, Putin is going to suffer horribly for this.
It does feel like as this kind of megalomaniacal autocrat, democratically elected but autocratic leader, that he is trying to fight the tides of history, and that, yes, he's winning now, but I think if the three of us came back in 10 or 20 years, it would be interesting to say, well, whatever happened to that push into Crimea, and what was the consequence, and what happened to Putin? Because he's trying to rebuild the glories of the old Soviet Empire in some new fashion, but it seems that it's only force that can accomplish that, and that just doesn't have a long term gain.
Not only to not have a long-term gain, though I agree with you entirely on that point, Putin is creating a Ukrainian national identity. I mean, up until a few weeks ago, a lot of Ukrainians sort of weren't actually that bothered about whether they were Russian or Ukrainian. Now it's a life-or-death issue. He is building the Ukrainian nation, the last thing he wanted to do.
Maybe this is just the moment to broaden the picture a little bit on this same topic. How is this being perceived elsewhere around the area? We've got Belarus, worried about NATO expansion. We've got Sweden thinking, gee, maybe we ought to be in NATO
Sweden
for another reason.
Sweden, I mean, when Sweden talks about joining NATO, having endured its neutral position for the last century, it's interesting. I mean, it's not like the Russians are about to invade Sweden, but you know, they survived through two world wars without actually joining the Western alliances, and now they're feeling more inclined to do so, which would leave only Finland as a non-aligned country in that part of the world. This is another one of the miscalculations. I don't think that Putin has designs on Sweden, but Sweden clearly is feeling insecure as they watch this.
Absolutely. And in particular, Sweden worries about the island of Gotland, which is too close to Russia for comfort and which they feel they can't defend themselves. They need NATO help. If Sweden joins NATO, and if the dominoes keep falling and Finland joins NATO, I mean, that symbolically in Moscow is going to be very, very painful.
And by the way, you're hearing voices out of Latvia, Estonia, etc., saying, thank God we are, you know, we are part of the Western alliance. Thank God we are, you know, we are not sitting like Ukraine, vulnerable.
Yes, whereas the voices you don't hear are the ones in Helsinki and Stockholm saying, oh dear, we're not, shouldn't we be doing something about it? Yeah.
And of course, one country just a little further away I want to mention, I think you do too, John, is Serbia. They've
absolutely
just had an election. Yeah. They've brought in a centre-right Europhile, we can call him, somebody who's changed his nationalist tune. That must be giving some jitters too, somewhere.
Absolutely. Serbia, one of the countries with which historically Russia has had the closest ties. Remember, it was in some aspects Russian links with Serbia that precipitated the First World War. That was the alliance that actually sparked it. And here we have Serbia voting in a government that wants to tilt towards the EU. Now, Moscow has spent a lot of the last several years trying to strong-arm Serbian governments into appointing pro-Kremlin ministers. It's been trying to reabsorb Serbia into the Russian sphere of influence. Now, all that's just gone. They've lost Serbia, too. Another one down.
So is it now the job of the EU to actually step up and do rather more? I understand now they've lifted duty on exports from Ukraine to sort of say, we want to help you guys. But really, isn't it true it's a chance for the EU to get together and really come up with a plan for Ukraine?
Yes, it is. A chance or a challenge, depending how you look at it.
Both?
Both, sure. I very much hope the EU does step up to the plate. And we have to recognize this is going to cost a lot of money. Ukraine is bankrupt. And trying to bail it out is going to cost an enormous amount.
I think it's going to cost money on two fronts. One is 15, 30 billion in cash imminently. But the other is just how much stomach the European leaders have for the potential loss of business from the Russians if they were to impose sanctions. You know, the city, the financial district here in London, very much operates and requires to sustain itself a lot of that money, even if it is of questionable origin. And you know, we had that very disturbing memo that was caught by a camera from one of David Cameron's staffers about 2 weeks ago, which said we don't want to imperil the financial security of the city, of London's financial markets by imposing sanctions, which suggests that money's talking more than politics or policy here. And, you know, so they're going to have to make some tough decisions. And of course, so much of Europe now depends on Russian natural gas.
Sure. First of all, on that memo, I wouldn't go big on the memo. If you go to these meetings, and I've sat through more of them than is good for my health, everybody comes along with different drafts and different ideas. That was one set. And if you watch the way that the UK negotiated within the EU following that meeting, that clearly is not a view that prevailed. Yes, preserve the city, but something has to be done about Ukraine. Is money talking louder than politics? I'm not so sure right now. Russia has been important for a long time. There's a sense around that it just doesn't matter quite so much as it used to. There's a sense, too, the damage is done, that already we've seen billions of Russian money leave the West, leave the city, and go back to Russia. Perversely and paradoxically, the first impact of supposed economic sanctions is to swell Putin's coffers.
We'll take a break in a moment. Just before we go, China. China and Russia are sort of the friends at the moment. Do we have a new Eastern Bloc?
No, we do not have a new Eastern Bloc. Friends, hey, with friends like that. China, of course, is trying to keep out of this, is saying the most muted things in the Security Council, abstained on the crucial vote, yeah, left Russia in the lurch. And all the while this is going on Russia's Western approaches, China is cheerfully nibbling away at the eastern part of what used to be the Soviet Empire, closer links with Kazakhstan, a new gas pipeline coming in from Turkmenistan, which always used to send its gas into Russia, no longer. And bit by bit, the encroachment, as Putin would see them, on Russian traditional territories in the West are being matched by Chinese depredations in the East.
Well, we're going to take that short break now that I mentioned. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Nancy Durham, and my guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard. When we return, we'll discuss the irony of China backing North Korea's human rights record.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Well, thank you for listening to us at Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, of course, are Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard. A major UN report on human rights in North Korea is on the agenda of the Human Rights Council in Geneva today. Unlike former case studies, this report is one that calls for action as it deals with the way the Kim family has ravaged the country for over 50 years. The report has accused Pyongyang of systematic murder, torture, and starvation of its people, a damning account that has chilled a large part of the international community. But for China, all of this has been fabricated. Chen Chuan-dong, a Chinese diplomat, has said Beijing would not back the UN report and would veto any resolution at the Security Council. Well, John, we're just talking about new alliances before we had that little break. What does Beijing's backing of Pyongyang mean?
This is fairly standard stuff. Beijing does not like investigations into human rights because Beijing fears that if such investigations become common practice, somebody might start one on Chinese human rights, or rather lack of them. And so it routinely disses these reports. And the language is used here, that the Commission of Inquiry, that its findings are not valid because it couldn't get into North Korea, is the kind of approach that it's used before. But there's another big aspect here. Right now, Beijing does not want to rattle North Korea, because the day before the Chinese made this statement, the North Koreans issued their own statement in an expanded session of the Central Military Commission, which is the governing body of North Korea, that they were going to display their armed might for as long as America remained hostile, which people think means another nuclear test. So Beijing is, in any case, going to have a very difficult, very recalcitrant North Korea to deal with quite soon. Why pick a fight on this issue?
They just fired 25 rockets into the sea as kind of a provocative action. These are limp. It's a limp gesture, but clearly North Korea is feeling the need to assert itself. I think that on a broader question, what this report raises, and when you look at it, it's so disturbing, and it validates what I think anyone who's read anything about North Korea worries about, is just what will the world do? Are we just going to sit back and shrug and say, well, gee, this is horrible, that's terrible, we can't do anything? And, you know, I think just a constant theme in these kind of global issues is transparency. And, you know, we now know. We can't pretend we don't know. And are we just going to say, well, the political cost is just too high and China doesn't want us to do anything, so we're going to let them brutalize, torture, starve millions of people?
I think the report demonstrates, or rather the Chinese reaction to the report, let's be specific, demonstrates quite clearly that the United Nations machinery is once again going to fail, that it is not going to deliver the stinging resolution and the call for action that you have a moral right to expect from the United Nations. I very much hope, though, that this report, which is quite stomach-churning reading, does spur others to action. It's circulated very widely around government circles, academics, NGOs, and I don't think it can leave anybody in doubt as the horrors that now go on in North Korea's concentration camps.
But as Jeffrey says, you know, we know these things. How do we then harness the energy to go with the information to act? What on earth can be done?
That is the $64,000 question, isn't it? And I think my own view is that the only way that we are going to close these camps is for the North Korean government either to change fundamentally or more likely to fall.
Right. You need a leadership change there. I mean, you need a regime change, as we remember that term.
I remember the term very well. The trouble in the case of North Korea is that if there were a regime change, then the people likely to take over from Kim Jong-un would make Kim Jong-un's rule look like kind of golden era of liberal prosperity in comparison. Some of them are distinctly creepy. And I don't think any of them have on their agenda to close North Korea's concentration camps.
Before we move on, do we dare try to link any of this conversation with what we've been talking about with Crimea? You know, we have China over there being a bit friendly with North Korea. China and Russia have got something going.
It's possible, though I think the immediate linkage is not Crimea, it's the US ROK, the US South Korean joint military exercises. They, every year, they conduct these exercises. Every year, North Korea protests, and every year, North Korea makes greater or smaller gestures of disapproval. This time, as you rightly said, it's launched 25 missiles. I think that Crimea and things that are going on there probably upset North Korea, because North Korea doesn't like to see international instability that might affect its own chances of survival. But I don't think that was the immediate spur for what they did.
And did you want to make that point you made during the break? There are people demonstrating in Moscow.
Absolutely. We have to remember that just a few days ago, we had tens of thousands of people in Moscow demonstrating against the war, saying, not against the war, against the annexation of Crimea, saying that that what is going on is the shame of Russia, stid Russia. This is strong language. And remember that Putin's own domestic mandate is shaky, that whether or not he was democratically elected is still an open topic for debate. And that in Moscow in particular, there's a strong majority against Putin.
Well, we are going to move on. We've got a couple of minutes and we're going to bring up that airplane. There's more confusion surrounding the disappearance of the Malaysian Airlines aircraft. Over the weekend, we've been told that this is likely to have been a hijacking after all. This morning, we learned that the co-pilot last spoke to ground controllers after it vanished, making him a suspect in the disappearance of the aircraft. Now, Malaysian authorities have backtracked, saying he actually spoke those words just before the plane's tracking devices were switched off. Jeffrey, what do you make of this?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, you have to feel for the families of these people. I mean, this is just the notion in the 21st century that a Boeing 777 could just disappear from the sky with no trace is just, and for, you know, all of us who fly, you know, everybody, you know, I'm pretty much all of us do, it's chilling. You just assume that there'll be some sort of track. I think, though, that one of the biggest conclusions for me is just to watch the Malaysian government bungle this day to day. And it's interesting, you know, I used the word transparency a moment ago, but it's interesting to see how under the scrutiny of the world spotlight, and this is a drama that is really understandably compelling and consuming, that Malaysia just can't get it right. They don't have the expertise, the sophistication. They don't know what it is to be accountable. And as someone who's covered a lot of international crises, I mean, I think there's a very telling moment in this. When I reported on the Chile mine rescue and spent most of the 7 weeks of that rescue there, one of the things that defined the success of that rescue was Chile saying, hey, we can run this, but we need all the help we can get. We're not too proud to say, come on in Australia, South Africa, Canada, America, with all of your expertise and your drillers and your equipment. You saw in that terrible collapse in the Rana Plaza in Bangladesh, the Bangladeshis would not let people in. They felt that it would have been a sense of weakness, and they would have been sending out a signal that they couldn't handle it. And so it's fair to say in that crisis, in that terrible tragedy, many more people died than necessary because they wouldn't let searchers in from Britain and Sweden and other places. In this case, Malaysia is saying to the U.S., we don't want the FBI. And I think that when you see that on a crisis of this nature, it's indicative of a leadership that's more concerned about its own pride and ultimately flawed than it is about the outcome.
Can I come in on a entirely different point? I mean, I wouldn't want to speak to any of that, but that the fact that we're now looking across two arcs, one going north, one going south, opens up the bizarre possibility that I don't think it's yet been commented on, that the plane may not have crashed. That they may actually have affected an orderly landing somewhere in the waste of Central Asia, and that plane.
You really think that?
No, I don't think that.
It's not impossible.
You think that there are 270 odd people somewhere.
That this was carefully planned, and that somebody actually landed that plane, camouflaged it, and moved the passengers off.
10 days later, that we still.
I'm glad somebody said it.
This is a Hollywood plot now.
Yes, it's been that way for some time.
It already was.
Yeah,
we've got to leave it there. Sadly, thanks so much for coming in. It's been great to see you both again, Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard. We'll see you again at Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monaco 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Woof. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be in Montreal and in New York, where we'll look back at the time of the late 60s, early 70s, when the West lost its cultural inhibitions. Author Robert Hoffler tackles the subject in his book, Sexplosion. But before we get started on that, here's Bill Bingham with the world's latest news.
Ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych is among officials who've been given travel bans and had their assets frozen as Western powers hit back over Crimea's referendum. Other figures include Sergei Aksionov, Crimea's acting leader, Dmitry Rogozin, a Russian deputy prime minister, and Valentina Matviyenko, head of the upper house of the Russian parliament. The European Union's measures target 21 people, but their names are not being released until later. Officials in Malaysia say they believe the co-pilot of missing flight MH370 spoke the last words to ground controllers before it vanished. Initial investigations indicate that co-pilot Farik Abdul Hamid said, "All right, good night," shortly before the plane disappeared. Investigators are looking into the possibility that the Boeing 777's crew were involved in its disappearance. Mick Jagger's fashion designer girlfriend, Elren Scott, has been found dead in her New York City apartment. A spokesman for Mick Jagger, who's on tour in Australia, said the singer was completely shocked and devastated. Police say the death is being investigated as a possible suicide. U.S. Navy SEALs have taken control of an oil tanker seized by rebels earlier this month at a Libyan port by three armed men. The seizure embarrassed the Libyan government after the vessel was loaded with oil and managed to escape from the port. The Pentagon says no one was hurt as the military gained control of the ship. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Bill Bingham. Welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we're heading to Montreal for a chat with our man there, Patrick Pittman. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Quebec elections are all over the news. Tell us what's going on.
Well, it's been an interesting campaign so far, announced a week or so back. The elections are on April 7th. Everybody thought it was going to be about the Charter of Values, the banning of hijabs in the public service, but it's taken a little bit of a surprise twist with a media baron entering the race.
You've called him a sort of Berlusconi-type figure.
Yeah, I like to look at Pierre Carl Péladeau as a little bit of a pocket Berlusconi, a Quebec-sized one, I suppose. But he does control 40% of the media here in Quebec through his Québécois Corporation, which he inherited from his father. We're talking newspapers, cable networks, has been working on getting a hockey franchise happening in Quebec City. And also, outside of Quebec, is in, owns the Toronto Sun and various other tabloids like that.
So media mogul. And he had a little encounter that was captured on video this week. Tell us about the circumstances of that, would you?
Yes. Well, so Pauline Marois is the leader of the Parti Québécois, who Pierre Carl Péladeau is running with, although most people are thinking he's not going to be content for too long to maybe be behind her as a backbencher. And he's certainly been outshadowing her in the campaign so far. At one of the campaign stops earlier in the week, media were putting questions directly to him instead of her. When he leaned in to answer a question at the microphone, she not so subtly shoved him away from the podium. And that's gone a little bit viral as well.
We're, the sovereignty word is back on the agenda again, or this, you've called it the neverendum. What's happening there? Is there some sort of, is there development?
Well, it's never entirely off the agenda in Quebec, given that it's often the only thing people talk about. But it wasn't really expected to be at the center of the campaign. But when Pierre Carl Péladeau joined in his speech, he said that he was joining the Parti Québécois because he wanted to live in an independent Quebec and give one to his children. Suddenly, it's the only thing they were talking about, which I think took the party by surprise as well. Now we can't really talk about anything else other than a referendum.
How is it playing for them? Do people want to talk about a referendum at this moment?
Oh, they don't, but people do. And I mean, this is when you talk to people on the street, they're like, sure, you can talk about the economy, you can talk about jobs, but if this is your end game, then this is what the election needs to be about. And to be honest, it's not going that well for them. They hadn't really thought out a strategy. So when Pauline Marois has been asked questions about what an independent Quebec might look like, she's been sort of musing on the spot about what borders could look like, whether there'd be passports, what the dollar would be, that kind of thing. And people haven't been too impressed with her answers. And it is looking like maybe that's sort of playing into the hands of the Federalist Liberal opposition.
Are there any pollsters giving us information on what the people want?
The polls are pretty vague at this stage. There have been a few come through that have suggested that, look, maybe about 40% of Quebecers looking for a referendum, looking for independence, which is, you know, enough for it to be a serious discussion, but not enough to get a party over the line. And the fact of it is that this debate always scares a lot of people as well, and people tend to retreat to their corners when the issue comes up.
Changing tacks now for our last discussion here. The Canadian soldiers have now withdrawn from Afghanistan.
Yeah, this didn't get a lot of fanfare. There was a low-key flag folding in Kabul, but after 12 years, the last Canadian soldiers left a training mission in Afghanistan this week.
What's the feeling in Canada? You say there wasn't a lot of fanfare, but do people, why hasn't there been fanfare?
It's strange. There's an ongoing debate over the last few months about the legacy for the Canadian soldiers in Afghanistan. There's been a spate of suicides of soldiers when they've returned. There's been the closing of Veterans Affairs offices around the country. Lots of discussion on the radio and in the papers about post-traumatic stress disorder and the like. But I think The issue is that nobody really knows what was achieved there. There was 12 years that went into it. And I don't think, you know, anybody on either side of government particularly feels like they have any ownership over that conflict. And so I think that they were pretty happy to just sort of let it leave out the back door, leaving the soldiers being the only ones who are really remembering that.
Well, we'll leave it there then. And thank you very much, Patrick Pittman, our Montreal correspondent, talking with us there. Up next, we'll chat with Robert Hoffler about his book, Sexplosion. You definitely want to stay around for that. This is Midori House, and I'm Nancy Durham.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage, and insight.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Brown.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro,
I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietrich.
From Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham. Well, after the sexual revolution came the sexual explosion. That, in a nutshell, sums up Robert Hofler's book, Sexplosion, an examination of the time when American and British cultures lost all inhibitions. In his book, Hofler looks back at the 6 years between 1968 and 1973, when film, literature, theater, and music started to challenge sexual taboos, from Andy Warhol's provocative pieces to the musical Hair. You may remember this song from the play.
Sodomy, fellatio, cunnilingus, pederasty. Father, why do these words sound so nasty?
Well, that was a first for our show, I think. That was the infamous song Sodomy, as sung in the movie inspired by Hair the musical. Now to discuss the 1970s sexplosion, we are joined by the author himself, Robert Hofler, live from our New York bureau. Hi there, Robert.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, and how about you?
Very good, very good. A little cold here in New York.
Yeah, well, it's a bit chilly here too, but great to hear you. And I'm finding it hard to imagine a time when sex wasn't everywhere. Can you take us back in time before all this happened?
Well, I called the book Sexplosion because there really was an explosion of sex material actually in January of 1968. That Lindsay Anderson got the go-ahead to start on his movie If with Malcolm McDowell, which had, you know, a kind of very explosive nude wrestling scene with a young actress. And there was also Marlon Brando was working on Candy in Italy, and Jane Fonda was working on Barbarella in Italy. And then also Gore Vidal's novel about a transsexual, Myra Breckinridge, was published. Mark Crawley wrote Boys in the Band, which of course was the first play that really featured a lot of gay characters. In fact, all the characters are gay except for maybe one. So that just seemed to me this incredible explosion. Also, Andy Warhol, the FBI here in the United States opened a file on Andy Warhol because he was making a film in Arizona. Generally, his films had been made in New York, but he decided to go to Arizona for this one because it was a Western called Lonesome Cowboys. And the townspeople got very upset. Because there were a lot of gay actors, and also there was a scene where one of his actresses, Viva, is gang raped. And so the townspeople got very upset with Andy, and the FBI opened a file. Anyway, that was just such an explosion. But really, kind of before that, there had been all of these court cases having to do with Lady Chatterley's Lover or Tropic of Cancer, the novel Candy. So those court cases had all been decided that those novels could be published, and that helped. There had been an arrest of Lenny Bruce, who, of course, used a number of four-letter words within his comedy act, but he was dead, and those court cases had been resolved. So all of a sudden, particularly here in the United States, you had Warner Brothers released Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in 1966. And the kind of Hays office or the Breen office, which was our kind of unofficial censor, did not approve the movie, but Warner Brothers decided they were going to release it anyway. I mean, it was Liz Taylor and Richard Burton. And then also there was Michelangelo's Antonioni's first English language movie made in Britain, Blow Up. And that featured some frontal nudity, only for about 3 seconds. And there again, MGM released it, and they were not given approval by the unofficial U.S. censor, but they released it anyway. So that was the end of that unofficial censor, which was the Hays office. And then you got the R and the X and all of that. Britain certainly had the Lord Chamberlain office, was still very active with a guy named John Trevelyan, and he figures very prominently in the book. Because movies like Women in Love at that time, you know, had to submit a script to him. And Women in Love was kind of the big one where he said it could never be filmed because there's a rape sequence between Oliver Reed and Glenda Jackson. And there was also a nude wrestling scene between Alan Bates and Oliver Reed that was very homoerotic. And he says, this can never be filmed. But they were very smart, Ken Russell and Larry Kramer, on that movie, in that they were very faithful to a classic British novel, of course, Women in Love by D.H. Lawrence. And so they approved it. And basically, Trevelyan was, he actually did kind of help some of the filmmakers, because he really did try to work with them in trying to get these movies released. But I think it was in 69 that was really kind of the end of his office.
Robert, I don't know if we can divide these two things, but when I remember back to that time and the huge buzz that was going on around Hair, and it was going to be on the stage, and you were actually going to see genitals. I mean, that's what people were talking about, just the idea of seeing the naked body publicly like that. How much was it about sheer nudity being, you know, that was the revolution, and how much was it about sex? Can you separate those?
Well, nudity and sex. Well, Hair was a very special case because the law was that you could, this was true in New York City, that you could be nude on stage as long as you didn't move, and it was a tableau. And so that was a tableau. And they did not, they waited to take Hair to Britain 1 year because of the censors, because Kenneth Tynan was also doing O Calcutta at that time. And the reason that they opened it off-Broadway in 1969 is that O Calcutta was going to test the law and have a nude ballet. And also, you were going to have actors who would, their genitals might touch. So that was really taboo in 1969. But he got away with it in New York, and that's why they kind of delayed the opening of Hair and then O Calcutta in London, because Kenneth Tynan did not want to be a test case, because he had already used the F word on the BBC, which was the first time, and that was in 1966. And of course, he was a major critic, and he had been against censorship. So he was afraid that his O Calcutta was going to be a test case. So they kind of let Hair test the waters in London, and then they brought over O Calcutta. I guess that didn't answer your question,
did it? It was kind of an interesting riff anyway.
I
think there was just a sort of a whole hang up about nudity, and then all of a sudden you could see penises.
You weren't
supposed to see this, and then everything broke open.
Well, you know, it is interesting because I'm kind of working on another book now, and you can see why female nudity was more acceptable than male nudity, because one, you know, organs are internal and the other are external. So, you know, there is kind of a thing there. But what happened with O Calcutta is that, see, they were dancing on stage naked. So that kind of passed over into sex as opposed to just nudity.
Got it.
And so there I kind of answered your question a little bit.
You did. Thank you. I've got another one for you. Do you think, when you look back at these works, do they stand up?
Yes, they really do. I have to say, I saw a tape of O Calcutta, and it's not great. Certainly, Hair has been revived, and it's great. I think Women in Love holds up. I mean, the other movies that I go into in great detail are The Making of Midnight Cowboy, of course, by another British, but his first American feature, John Schlesinger.
I'm completely mm-hmm. blanking out on the sex in Midnight Cowboy.
Well, he's a Times Square hustler, and he's a Texas dishwasher, John Voight, who comes to New York City because he wants to be a gigolo, but he doesn't have any luck with the women, so then he starts sleeping with men to make money. So that is, and of course, there was a scene in there of fellatio, but you don't see anything. It's taking, you know what's going on because one of the actors, you know, face disappears in the other guy's lap. So you know that there's fellatio going on in a movie balcony. And when Midnight Cowboy was nominated for Academy Awards for Best Picture, the Academy came to John Schlesinger and said, can we cut the fellatio scene? Because, and then we will give the film an R, but we don't want the Academy Award sullied with an X. And John Schlesinger told them, no way, I'm not cutting that scene. And of course, the movie went on to win an Academy Award anyway. And he won the Academy Award when he was working on another really great movie that has not been seen a lot in the United States. I don't know how it did in Britain, but that's Sunday Bloody Sunday, which of course was a menage a trois. And that was an amazing movie. I have to tell you, the one that doesn't really quite hold up, and it got so many good reviews when it first came out, was Last Tango in Paris, the Bertolucci movie with Marlon Brando, which I find kind of turgid when I watched it.
I haven't seen it a second time, and once was enough the first time.
I think so.
I think we're going to have to make that our last tango. But okay. Thank you so much. All the best. Good to hear you. Robert Hoffler, author of Sexplosion, from Andy Warhol to A Clockwork Orange, How a Generation of Pop Rebels Broke All the Taboos. A little while ago, we played you a bit of the musical Hair, and we thought we just couldn't let you go without giving you a little bit more of that fabulous musical, so wait for it. This is Aquarius. You're listening to Midori House. That was Aquarius, as performed in Hair, the film by Milos Forman. Well, digital art is almost as old as the computer itself, and yet only now is the art world taking serious notice. Screens are slowly pushing canvases out of the art galleries, and the Lumen Prize, the first prize entirely devoted to digital art, is trying to be ahead of the curve. This week, the Lumen Prize exhibition opens at the Triangle Space at Chelsea School of Art and Design in London, before moving on to Hong Kong. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Carla Rapoport, the CEO of the prize. Hello, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you for having me.
May seem like a very obvious question, but what is digital art?
Anything created on a computer or an iPad, a tablet, anything created digitally, obviously not anything with a paintbrush.
And why is it taking off now? And why has it taken till now, you might say?
Think about how ubiquitous the screen is. In the last couple of years, the iPad, the smartphone, suddenly these devices are everywhere. And the software to create digital art is much more accessible to almost anyone.
Do you want to tell us about some of the more exciting examples you've come across?
Sure. The range is amazing. I thought it was iPad painting when I started. I was inspired by Hockney.
Me too. We all thought we could do that then.
Actually, the more I looked into it, Hockney's starting to look kind of, oh, not that. I'm sorry to say. There's so much going on with interactive art, web-based art, art that's an app. I brought one in to turn on and show you. It's called PureFlow.
PureFlow, so that's an app you can have on your phone.
You can download it for free. I'm going to activate it now. And it picks up signals, GPS signals, and what you're hearing is the app. I can stroke it and change the sound. And can you see that, Nancy?
So, yeah, and is that a sound effect intended to go with the art?
It's creating the sound effect through the GPS signals in the air.
That was cool. It's kind of like a tartan strobe effect.
Exactly. I don't want to keep it on too long.
No, but I'm getting it. I get it now.
Absolutely. And you can touch it and change it.
Okay, I've got your phone now. And if you touch the panel, you get something different.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the PureFlow app.
That's one of the pieces, yeah. That's by an artist who lives in Bristol, and I'm just really proud to be showing it. We have another piece you can step into that uses a piece of Xbox technology, Kinect. And
so
you walk into the piece. It makes a sort of image of you that pixelates and rains down. So it used to be you had to go into the Haywood Gallery to see these kinds of things, but now people are making them so that you can put them up in your house or if you want it in your home, and come to the Triangle Space and see how you can walk around it. And it isn't just museums. It's just about anybody and everybody now thinking about it.
I read that Yang Yong Liang is a youngish Chinese artist who's into digital art, and that he was one of your inspirations for the Lumen Prize. And I saw a bit of his work online, and I was very impressed.
Me too.
Mixture of photography and digital effects,
exactly.
Possibly?
Well, it's 1,000 different pictures that he uses to create his image. He was trained as a classical Chinese painter, did those landscapes, and then he realized he could create the landscapes with thousands of photos. So it's actually a Photoshop extravaganza. But now he's moved into moving pictures with waterfalls in them. And it is pretty incredible to watch his work develop.
And the prize, we're going to have to wrap in a few seconds, but the prize is, I guess, intended to encourage more.
That's right. To celebrate this fantastically widely enabling technology, to celebrate and to bring more people to it and to make it feel more part of the art establishment.
Great. So go see it, everybody. Carla Rapaport, CEO of the Lumen Prize, thanks so much for coming in to see us. And that is all we have time for today on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard, and to Carla Rapaport. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi. Stay tuned here on Monocle 24 for Culture with Rob Bound. This week, there's live music from Canadian songstress Chloe Charles. We'll speak to Saoirse Ronan, one of the stars of the new Wes Anderson flick, The Grand Budapest Hotel. And we meet John Hegarty, the advertising whiz behind some of the biggest campaigns for the likes of Levi's, Lynx, and Audi.
Ones who are enjoying what they're doing and who see the opportunities within it and have a sense of humor are the ones who seem to do the better work and sustain their creative careers.
I'll be back at 2200 with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. That's it for this edition. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.